Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, August 22nd. I'm Alan Chartok. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from Ichiban, Japanese and Chinese restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, and Thai entries. Daily specials delivery, expanding to Gilderland, 518-432-0358. Joining us today is Dr. Alan Sanders, board certified in internal medicine, infectious diseases. Comes to us from Upstate Infectious Diseases Associates in Albany and from Albany Memorial, Saratoga, and St. Peter's Hospital, where he is chief of infectious diseases and chief of medicine. He's here to answer your question, 1-800-348-2551. That's 1-800-348-2551. But today, do it by email at voxpop@wamc.org because the phones aren't working. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today is a real heavy hitter, infectious diseases expert, Dr. Alan Sanders. Dr. Sanders is president and partner of Upstate Infectious Diseases Associates in Albany and serves as clinical instructor in medicine and infectious diseases at Albany Medical College. And if that wasn't enough, he's also the chief of infectious diseases at Albany Memorial Hospital, Saratoga Hospital, and St. Peter's Hospital, where he's also chief of medicine and chairman of the medication safety group. Dr. Sanders earned his medical degree from Albany Medical College. He completed his residency at Albany Medical Center and an internship at New England Deaconess Hospital. He's board certified in internal medicine and infectious disease. He's a fellow and member of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Got a question for Dr. Sanders, and I know you do. We can only tell you that the phones seem to be down this morning. We're working on it as hard as we can work. Our cracked engineering staff is working on that very diligently. So we're going to ask that you do it the way you do it in the mornings. Email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. If you have an infectious disease or a sepsis issue, and we're going to talk a little bit about sepsis this morning. Afternoon. What is sepsis, doctor?
Well, Alan, the definition in our dictionaries is that sepsis is a toxic condition coming from the spread of bacteria or the products of bacteria from some focus of infection in the body. Mm-hmm. As physicians, we think about it more like a dysregulation due to an infection someplace in the body, and it would lead to some dysfunction of any number of organs from head to toe. So is it a body becoming overwhelmed by an infection?
So there's a common sense that this happens mostly in hospitals, but that ain't true, is it?
It is not true. I work mostly in the hospital. We do take care of a lot of patients who are already in the hospital who develop sepsis, but most of the cases of this condition, sepsis, actually results from people who are at home getting into the hospital. So it's something they acquire at home from an infection that goes awry.
That's a very interesting thing. So what do we do in our homes to keep ourselves safer?
Well, it's not necessarily an unsafe environment. It's just really the patients, their families, caregivers, and especially clinicians who are not in the hospital need to have a heightened awareness about a patient's condition that may have gone from a simple infection to the condition of sepsis. That means the infection is not being controlled, the infection is galloping along, and that person is in the throes of a much more serious condition. So it's not the home environment, it's just that's where it happens.
But are there things that we can do to prevent the bacteria from overtaking us?
Sure. Some of sepsis is actually due to the type of bacteria we're talking about, but a lot of times it's due to the kind of a host we're dealing with. That is the patient. So some people have poorly functioning immune systems. They may be on chemotherapy for cancer. they may be taking different medications for certain diseases like steroids that will impact their immune system. Or they may just be elderly and therefore their immune systems don't work well. But some people can be completely healthy, completely normal, and it's just the bacteria itself that has a profound impact on a very healthy person.
Diabetes?
Diabetes is also a condition that puts somebody at greater risk for going from infection to sepsis.
Well, we're ready for calls, and we can take them now. Our crack engineering group has come up with a solution, and we appreciate that very much. In the meantime, we have Chris has sent in an inquiry, which is Dr. Sanders. A friend was recently hospitalized for an acute case of babesiosis.
Mm-hmm.
He had tested positive for Lyme and been taking antibiotics for several days. He was getting sicker and sicker. He talked to his family practitioner, but she was not concerned. When he became severely debilitated and spiked a fever 103, he went to his local ER where they had diagnosed babesiosis. Are the symptoms of babesiosis different from Lyme? Shouldn't a babesiosis test be included automatically when a patient has tested positive for Lyme? Thank you, Chris in Cornwall.
So that's a good question. Babesiosis and another separate tick-borne infection called anaplasmosis can actually both lead to some pretty impressive acute symptomatology, much more so than simple old Lyme disease would. And babesiosis is like a North American malaria, essentially. It's a parasite that the tick that causes Lyme disease and the tick that spreads anaplasmosis can spread to the human, mostly in the Northeast, but there are cases in other parts of the country, mostly in our neighborhood, that causes the body's red blood cells to get infected and can just start to burst and get destroyed. That can lead to the dysregulation of the body's organs and can lead to a sepsis-like picture. So babesiosis is a very acute problem that usually affects people over the age of 60. Again, it's their immune systems that aren't working so well, or people who have poorly functioning immune systems. So I wouldn't say that anybody who has Lyme disease should be tested for babesiosis. There are some clean diagnostic tests you need to do, and if their blood counts aren't normal, that's what trigger a doctor to go look for babesiosis. But we do see it in the hospital quite a bit around here in the summertime.
Wow. So it's got to be somewhat frightening. It's got to be somewhat frightening when we see all of this happening.
Yes. So, you know, there are some important clinical clues that I've been presenting in different forums around the state of New York as part of an arrangement with an organization called IPRO, which is our state professional review organization, peer review organization, to assist doctors and patients and families in recognizing early phases of sepsis. So I think it's really important for not only doctors and hospitals to be very well trained with the use of antibiotics and diagnosing diseases, but clinicians who are family practitioners, OBGYNs, just general practice doctors, people working in urgent care centers, patients and their families to recognize things that may be experienced by a patient at home, like a change in their mental status. They get very confused, may not be urinating as frequently as possible. They may be having shaking chills. Their body may start to turn blue and purple at the fingertips. These are really all early warning signs. Someone's gone from a simple infection to sepsis, and they need to be attended to by a doctor in a hospital urgently.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. I'm told that the phones are working, and it's a good time for you to call, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And I see that we are lucky to have you here, Doctor, and I wanted to ask you, so if somebody has, for example, a diabetic sore on their body, any one of the manifestations, is that something that can lead to sepsis?
Absolutely. So anytime our skin is embarrassed by an infection or by an ulcer or by a penetrating wound, there are a number of bacteria that can lead to infection. But there are certain types of bacteria that have a predilection to cause overwhelming infection. and you've heard the expression MRSA or MRSA.
Indeed.
There's also a bacteria called Group A Streptococcus, which is actually the flesh-eating bacteria that can cause some very deep penetrating activity in the muscles and deeper into the compartments of the extremities. These bacteria can lead to overwhelming sepsis in a diabetic and anyone. So diabetics are prone to getting ulcers on their feet because they can't feel very well in their extremities. But if they do get certain types of bacteria, that can lead to an overwhelming infection. And again, that dysregulation of the body's response and can cause sepsis.
Wow. So do we have the necessary tools, medical tools, to fight sepsis?
Absolutely. It's getting to be a
I want to just amend my statement and say go a little further and be even more of a pain and say, but because we keep hearing that there are these super, these super bacteria that we don't, that have outdistanced our cures.
Sure. It's a big challenge for us in the world of infectious disease in the hospital these days. But these bacteria don't only reside in the hospital. They live outdoors in our communities these days. So a person may be at home being treated with an antibiotic by their physician with all the intents and purposes of curing them of the infection, but they could have a resistant bacteria that the doctor does not yet know about because tests are still pending. We see a lot of the resistant bacteria in our hospital walls, indoors, but there are a lot of these bacteria that live outside the hospital walls these days. So clinicians need to be aware of these bacteria. We have fewer and fewer new antibiotics coming onto the market these days to fight these resistant bacteria. It doesn't mean all of them can lead to sepsis, but these are really concerning for us because people can get them into their bloodstream, they can overwhelm them, and we have nothing else to give them sometimes other than what may be an inferior antibiotic.
So if you were to tell me what the level of death that is caused by sepsis is, you know, how dangerous a disease is it?
So there's certain gradations in sepsis. So you can have sepsis, you can go on to what we call severe sepsis when your blood pressure starts to drop precipitously and you require a lot of intravenous fluid. And then you can go on to septic shock when the body goes into shock. The kidneys don't work well anymore. The heart may not be working well. The blood pressure is dropping. The brain is not getting good blood flow, so you start getting very confused. Septic shock has a mortality anywhere between 20, sometimes to 70%, depending on what the bacteria may be. People die of septic shock in our hospitals every single day, despite all our best intentions in terms of the right antibiotic, all the fluids they need to get, all the right blood pressure medications to keep their blood pressure up. And despite all that, people still die of septic shock into the 20, 30, 40% range in our best hospitals.
That is really scary.
Very scary.
Here's one that came in at VoxPop at WAMC.org. For the doctor, what are the probable causes of the EB virus becoming reactivated? Of course, you're going to have to define all these terms for us, Doc.
Sure.
I've had a steady high viral load for years, not chronic but active, that becomes a bit higher with stress. And will it be with me for the rest of my life? Thank you. That's from Patricia.
Okay, Patricia. So Epstein-Barr virus, EB, Epstein-Barr virus, is by definition a virus. It's very rare to see a virus lead to sepsis, and it doesn't normally lead to anything as profound as septic shock. So there are a lot of viruses that people acquire in their early years that can lay latent in their body for the rest of their lives. There can be reactivation of a host of them. The chickenpox virus gets reactivated and causes shingles.
Yeah.
You know, Epstein-Barr virus can cause various levels of recrudescence and rear its ugly head once in a while, but it doesn't lead to organ dysfunction like we think about with a bacterial infection like sepsis.
Well, we're going to take a short break, Doc, and we'll be right back. And I apologize for our inadequacy here today.
Yeah. Support comes from the Brattleboro Retreat, providing hospital-based mental health services, including medically assisted alcohol withdrawal. BrattleboroRetreat.org for more information. Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center, offering a Master of Social Work degree, field instruction, and internships available. Adelphi.edu for more information. And from the Hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, healthquest.org for locations.
Certainly back, and we are very lucky to have Dr. Alan Sanders, president and partner of Upstate Infectious Diseases Associates in Albany, clinical instructor in medicine and infectious diseases at Albany Medical College, the chief of infectious diseases at Albany Memorial Hospital, Saratoga Hospital, and St. Peter's Hospital, where he is also chief of medicine and chairman of medication safety. So, Doc, tell me about what the chief of medicine has to do.
So it's mostly an administrative job, but I'm my job is to make sure that patients in the hospital are getting high quality care, that the doctors caring for them are providing the highest quality patient care. I'm involved with obviously any disciplinary action. Sometimes if physicians get into them, which thankfully is rare, patients' families make lodge complaints on occasion, and those things have to come up towards me. I do a lot of education activities in the hospital on a monthly basis, be it reviewing cases that went awry or just doing continuing education for our physicians and the rest of the people who work in the hospital. So it's an administrative job, but I do that about only 30 to 40% of the time.
Well, it sounds like you have a lot on your plate. I mean, even in just your practice, it's got to be immense.
I have three hats, one head.
Ladies and gentlemen, our phones are down, so at least temporarily. So we need you, if you have a question, and I know a lot of you do, to write us here at Vox Pop. It's voxpop at voxpop@wamc.org. Again, voxpop, one word, at voxpop@wamc.org. And we'll be glad to answer your questions in the order in which they come up. So I guess when we think of, I remember my wife once had pneumonia, and she was in the hospital in Great Barrington, and they were very assiduous. They'd come in all day long, and they would mop with that solution that we all know the smell of, and they would get the walls, and they would do everything. Is that de rigueur now?
Well, I mean, listen, a safe, sterile environment is, or as close to sterile as possible in the hospital is really our goal. We don't like to have unkept patient rooms. We don't want to see doctors and nurses, especially with hands that aren't clean. That's the first really barrier against infection. So we wash our hands religiously before and after all our patient contacts. A clean room is critically important. Mopping the floor terminally after a patient's leaving a room before another patient comes in is always part of hospital protocol. But, you know, our biggest problem in terms of infections are the bacteria that live in us and live on top of us. So people get infected just from things they're walking around with without even knowing about it. They have a perforation of their appendix. They can get into overwhelming sepsis. Mm-hmm. They have a bacteria in their urinary tract. They can get overwhelming urinary tract sepsis. Like you said, a pneumonia like your wife had. Those are bacteria that live in us. They're not coming from person to person. So a bacteria that resides or comes down into the lung can overwhelm us. It doesn't have to come from outside our environment or our own personal environment. There are obviously contagious diseases we worry about that go person to person or things that are in the environment. But much of what we're talking about with sepsis are unfortunately caused by things that we can't ever eliminate, bugs that live in us and bugs that live on top of us.
So when somebody comes to the emergency room and they're sitting in a big room filled with people, some of whom, most of whom have different kinds of problems, But some of them are really seriously infected. And what's the chances that they'll pass it on to somebody else?
So there are triage protocols that we follow very closely in our hospital. This is not just talking about things like, God forbid, Ebola and pandemic influenza, but every day of the week people come in, be it coughing, they may have an open wound, they may have a known bacterial infection. Our emergency departments are very rigorous about putting people in an isolation area so that anybody going into that room has to put on a gown, perhaps a mask, clearly gloves. Walking out, they have to discard all of that. That person is not in the general open venue of an emergency department. That we put these people in isolation. We put people in isolation rooms every single day up on the floors in the hospital.
Are there enough of them, Doc?
There are enough of them, yeah. I think we do a pretty good job of hotel management, moving people in and out of rooms when they no longer have a concerning infection that could be transmitted person to person. So we do get stressed, especially in the wintertime during influenza season, needing enough isolation rooms. But those protocols, from respiratory infections to things like meningitis to bad wound infections, resistant bacteria like you talked about, bad infectious diarrhea that can be transmitted person to person without good sterile procedure. Those folks get put in isolation rooms all the time. We have infection control specialists in our hospital who work with us as infectious disease doctors who do all that groundwork to keep people healthy and safe.
So now we have this onslaught of, at least it seems that way, of mosquito-borne diseases. How does that affect your life?
I get a lot of questions about it. It doesn't affect my life particularly up here in upstate New York, thankfully, because the scourge of Zika, thankfully, has not gone anywhere north of the southeastern United States at this point. But, you know, mosquitoes can transmit West Nile virus, which we've seen a lot of that in upstate New York. Obviously, you know, the ticks that are also insects that live in our area cause a lot more trouble for us than mosquitoes do around here. And, you know, the Albany, Greene County, Columbia County, Rensselaer County region of New York State is probably ground zero for Lyme, Anaplasma, and Babesia in this country at this point. So we are very well equipped to recognize it when it comes in. And I think people get good quality care when these diseases are accurately diagnosed.
So when somebody suspects they have it, they get the bullseye or their kid has a tick on them, is this emergency room stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it should be able to be managed very adequately by the family doctor. And this includes, you know, family practitioners, internists, the nurse practitioners and physician assistants who work with them. Lyme disease is not a difficult disease with a bullseye rash or some of the manifestations to recognize in the outpatient setting. You need not really go to an emergency department. And it's a rare thing for me to ever encounter someone in the hospital who has been overwhelmed by Lyme to get admitted. Anaplasmosis, though, another tick-borne infection caused by bacteria, and babesiosis, we alluded to before, are two infections that can really overwhelm people. And they get better pretty quickly with appropriate antibiotics. But I have even encountered patients, unfortunately, who've died of both of those diseases.
Maggie just wrote us at voxpop@wamc.org and wants to know about a little bit more specifically about the latest treatments. In other words, what antibiotics are you offering, or what's the best way to for you as the great specialist to disinfect somebody?
So you alluded to before the fact that there's a lot more resistant bacteria out there. We need to know accurately as quickly as possible from our microbiology laboratories, the people who actually get these specimens, blood, tissue, urine, pus, whatever it may be, to accurately identify those bacteria and tell us what that bacteria is going to be killed by with what antibiotic.
How do you do that?
Well, there's some pretty simplified tests that they actually do. They take the bacteria and they run it up against a series of different antibiotics and see if the bacteria lives or dies head-to-head against that panel. That takes a couple of days to happen oftentimes. And we work so rigorously with things like CAT scans and MRIs and all these fancy tests we have these days in the cardiology world. The microbiology laboratory and the infectious disease doctor are really still pretty methodical. So we have to give people very strong antibiotics up front to cover best guess about what may be going on and covering a lot of different territory with bacteria. And once we know exactly what it is, we can narrow our antibiotics down. So we hit hard, hit early with in cases of sepsis, and we figure out what the bacteria is. We back off and give the exact antibiotic for the exact bacteria.
So, Dr. Alan Sanders, the question then is, if you have Lyme babesiosis, is it babesiosis?
Babesiosis.
Babesiosis, I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
And other tick-borne diseases, each of these may be treated differently with a different antibiotic?
Yeah, actually, anaplasmosis and Lyme, thankfully, get treated by the same antibiotic,
which is doxycycline.
And the good thing about that in some ways is they may be dually infected with both infections at the same time, and you can get by with actually using that drug. But babesiosis has an entirely different combination of antibiotics to treat. So you need to be pretty good about your diagnostic skills.
Okay, Doc, the email is coming through now, and it's, again, voxpop@wamc.org. And Karen writes, my husband passed away due to this infection of his heart valves. It took months for a diagnosis, and it was too late. What can you tell me about this infection? Is there mouth-to-heart relationships? And thanks from Karen.
I think I know what she's describing there in terms of mouth-to-heart. And she's describing an infection that we encounter quite often in the hospital setting, and it's usually, well, most often starts on the outpatient side of things. Endocarditis is the name of the disease she's talking about. And it means an infection inside the heart, and specifically on a heart valve. And it's not an uncommon infection. People who have underlying abnormalities of their heart valves are the ones who are most likely to get this type of infection. And simple little bacteria that live in your mouth that you're spreading into your gums when you dental floss or brush your teeth, most of us have no problem clearing that out of our bloodstream without a problem. Those bacteria, mouth to the bloodstream, can sometimes latch onto an abnormal heart valve and start leading to a buildup of a little vegetation, we call it, like a little tiny piece of cauliflower that grows and grows and grows with bacteria, and it will destroy the heart valve if not diagnosed in time.
How does it present?
It presents kind of quietly, fevers, chills. I have an occasional sweat at nighttime. I'm losing some weight. I just don't feel myself. It's not a thunderclap illness like getting hit by lightning. Mm-hmm. Most folks who have a heart valve infection take up to sometimes 3 to 4 weeks to get to their doctor to figure out what's really going on. A simple test like a blood culture, taking blood out of the body, sending it to the microbiology laboratory, find the bacteria very quickly. That test will diagnose endocarditis, and we treat with antibiotics. I've taken care of a lot of people who just present too late. They aren't even really going to be saved by a heart valve replacement. That mm-hmm. even can happen sometimes. So people do die of endocarditis. Often it's because they present and get diagnosed too late.
And Karen, we're sorry about your loss. Thanks very much for letting us do that. Alexander wants to know, what is your opinion on electrolyte therapy for intubated ICU patients? Should the imbalance be corrected to normal limits? Also, can ECMO, capital, have a role in resuscitation with sepsis arrests?
Those are pretty intricate questions. And
since most of us have no idea what those things stand for, you'll help us.
Okay. So, pardon me. So the first part of that question about electrolyte imbalances, absolutely. The body has a whole array of chemistries that we need to keep balanced all the time. The big ones are sodium and potassium. And these electrolytes have a great deal of function in terms of the way our nerves work, our muscles work, our heart works. And we need to keep a very rigorous kind of balance. We call it homeostasis in our body with these chemicals. They can get terribly disturbed during sepsis because the kidneys can fail, the heart's not working right, and it's terribly important for us to replace or try to eliminate these chemicals in the body if there's not enough of them or too much of them. So we do that all the time. Even on dialysis machines, we have to use in setting of sepsis. The second part of the question, a heck of a lot more complicated, is something called ECMO, which is extracorporeal management of the body's bloodstream and oxygen. So this is almost like a heart-lung machine. When people get their heart operated upon, we got to get their body's blood oxygenated outside the body because the lungs and the heart aren't working together anymore. And there are these machines now which we can use in people who aren't undergoing heart surgery, where we take blood out of their body, get it oxygenated into a machine, and send it back into them to get their oxygen levels higher than their than the ventilator or a breathing machine can do because their lungs have failed. And I've been involved in probably a dozen cases using ECMO for overwhelming influenza. So that is the major time we have to use ECMO because the lungs can get so deteriorated from terrible flu that the body can't get oxygen any longer, and the machine's got to help the patient through it.
Okay, so that answers that one. Now let's go to Justin. When is the best time to get the influenza vaccine?
That's a great question.
Is there any need for a booster if you get vaccinated early in the season? Thanks, from Justin.
Sure. We always try to get people vaccinated really between August and October, as late as November. It's never too late to get vaccinated because the influenza starts to appear in our communities in November and December around here. You like to have enough time, at least 2 weeks after a vaccine, to get your immune system boosted up by that vaccine you received. If you receive a vaccine too early, quote unquote, not really too early, but early in the season, like August, September, and it's a late flu season, it goes into March, April, we even had it up until June 2 years ago. To get a booster per se is not really the question. Sometimes the vaccine is not a good match for the virus that's actually in the community. And on occasion, that individual may need to get a different type of flu shot if manufacturers are starting to put them out quickly enough. But the idea of a booster for healthy people is not really recommended. We give a higher dose of vaccine sometimes to people who have poorly functioning immune systems.
So, Doc, what if you forget, as I do, when you got it last year? Is it too much? Is there a risk of getting another shot too early, for example?
No, never. It's not a risk. And if you're actually, just interestingly, people, you know, it's summertime still, people travel to the southern hemisphere. So if you're going to the southern hemisphere between the months of March into September, you should get a flu shot for that travel because influenza circulates below the equator in their wintertime. So if you're going to be going to the Patagonian in Argentina or South Africa, and your travels during that summer, our summertime months, that's their wintertime. And people on cruise ships, people on, you know, airplane flights, people traveling in the southern hemisphere can get flu then. So if you haven't been vaccinated in our usual flu season, you can get a flu shot before you go away.
Very interesting. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. And from Nathan Litauer Hospital, Gloversville, New York, proudly introducing the gastroenterologist specialist of Litauer, working to provide patients with comfort during colonoscopy procedures. NLH.org.
We heard from BuzzBuzz, who says, "Hey, Doc, a friend's blood donation was rejected this year because of a babesiosis detection. What tick-borne illnesses are they finally testing for? And is the Red Cross or the New York Blood Bank, is donating blood now a free blood test for tick-borne illness?"
I wouldn't use the blood bank as a screening tool for getting diagnosed with these things, but the blood bank will pick things up like anaplasmosis and babesiosis because they can see them in the blood. They're visible. They're microscopic, but with a trained blood bank person, they'll actually see the parasites in the red blood cells for babesia, and they will see these what look like blueberries in the white blood cells for anaplasma. But again, just like I wouldn't go donating blood to see if I got HIV disease, just get an HIV test. You don't want this blood bank to be the one to look for it or miss it potentially.
I should say. And Molly wants to know, "I was bit by a tick in March and never had the general symptoms of Lyme disease, but now have a raised mark where the tick bit me and some muscle pain and knee pain in that leg. I was pregnant when I was bitten, so I could not take doxy, but did take amoxicillin."
Yes.
"Could I still have Lyme without the signs? Any doctors I should see in the area?"
Well, if you had an appropriate course of amoxicillin, which is equivalent to doxycycline and safe, there's really no reason to be on a chronic trajectory with Lyme disease at this point. An actual site at the initial tick bite may just be an irritation inflammatory process itself and should be looked at, because there could always be potentially a small little headpiece or mouthpiece left from a tick, and it can cause irritation there. If a joint is swollen, that's a different story as opposed to pain. If a joint is swollen, it should be looked at by an orthopedic doctor or your family doctor, and they can sample fluid from it, and you may potentially have a Lyme disease in that joint, and that can be evaluated and treated.
How effective, Doc, are the tests? So in other words, you know, if somebody thinks they're dragging and they go and say, I want to be tested for Lyme, they get tested. Do they find it?
So there's a great deal of controversy about the actual testing of Lyme disease, because the test is not perfect, but I always tell my colleagues and also patients that a Lyme test is only as good as a clinical picture predicts or a clinical picture presents. So simple fatigue or aches and pains without a focal finding, along with a quasi-positive Lyme test, doesn't hit a home run for me. Then again, people who have, florid positive Lyme test with a good clinical picture, be it a swollen joint, they may have Bell's palsy, they may have some neuropathy or some nerve damage or nerve inflammation, they could have some abnormality in their heart rhythm. All those clinical features, this is way beyond the bullseye rash in terms of time and complications. With a good supportive Lyme test is great. A Lyme test orbiting out there by itself without clinical picture, that's not a confirmatory Lyme test, just a little bit positive or a lot of bit negative, is not a helpful tool. And I think we need a better test. It's just that, unfortunately, we don't have the technology out there yet, I think, perfected, like things like PCR testing, polymerase chain testing for Lyme, that can be really clinched. The CDC is always, helping us confirm these things, but we're still a little bit away from it.
Hello, says John. Should one be routinely tested for sepsis? Everyone? At a certain age?
So let me just redefine sepsis again for us. Sepsis is not an infection. Sepsis is the body's response to an overwhelming infection. It's a condition. So you can't be tested for sepsis. There's no heralding features from it in terms of blood work or anything like that. There's no complaint. Somebody says, I feel a little bit septic today, like being a little bit pregnant today. Sepsis is the body's overwhelming response with some dysfunction of major organs to a focus of bacterial infection. So if you have a bladder infection, you have a skin infection, you have a pneumonia, you have an overwhelming sinus infection or ear infection, you have an overwhelming strep throat, if you have a gastrointestinal infection, if you have a bad wound infection, all those things are all things that could lead to sepsis. So of course you're going to get tested for an infection when you come up with those kind of complaints. But just there's no screening test, as it were, for telling somebody they have sepsis or a little bit of sepsis.
I have two friends with Lyme, says Donna, who talk about their brain fog. Could you explain this condition?
So there are some individuals who have Lyme disease, and despite treatment for Lyme sometimes, they can have some late manifestations of some chronic Lyme syndrome pictures. We've had a lot of, I think, very well managed, randomized, placebo-controlled trials around the country and other parts of the world that have treated some of these more chronic manifestations, but more and more antibiotics aren't going to make that condition better, per se. It's not by any means under the category of sepsis or severe sepsis or, God forbid, septic shock.
Okay. Hello. Should one be routine? Oh, he did that one. Sorry about that. That was from John. I am 63 years old. I had a mild case of shingles in February. Do I have antibodies for it now, or should I get the vaccine this fall?
So that's a good question. So shingles is the same virus. The virus that causes shingles is the same virus that causes chickenpox. So individual has chickenpox as a kid. Over the course of the years, their antibodies from that original infection start to wane. Now, we've been vaccinating millions of children in this country against chickenpox in the last 20 years. So these grandparents, I'm not assuming that this person is a grandparent, but people who get into their 60s and 70s are exposed to fewer and fewer and fewer little kids who have chickenpox these days. Mm. Once you used to be exposed to those kids, it was a natural vaccination. You saw the virus again, your body got a little tickled by it, and your memory in your immune system started to get triggered, and you would make more antibodies, and you were actually kind of protected from getting shingles until later in your years. The curve is drifting a bit more to people in their 50s and early 60s getting shingles. People are getting it earlier. There's a shingles vaccine out there, which essentially is no different than the chickenpox vaccine.
Should we take it?
We should take it over the age of 60. Now, if someone's had shingles, their antibodies obviously weren't good enough. They didn't protect them. And they're getting the bout of shingles isn't going to make their antibodies go up by any means. They should get the vaccination after a short period of time just to keep them from getting shingles again, because it can happen again and again. So there's no real close time period, but I would definitely wait probably in the 3 to 6 month period after shingles to get a vaccine.
So what's the chances of a 75-year-old me getting shingles? Is it 100% if I had chickenpox?
It's not 100%, no. I'd say it's probably in the range of in the 50 to 70% chance of getting shingles later in life if you've had chickenpox as a kid. The immune protection wanes as years go on. I can't tell you there's a predictable, 80% chance that if you live to 90, you're going to get shingles. But clearly it's going to be higher if you're ever going to be taking anything that's going to suppress your immune system. That is chemotherapy, steroids, or if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, those folks are going to have a higher rate of potentially re-triggering their chickenpox virus.
We have heard from somebody, inevitably, about the Zika virus. I don't know if you want to talk about it today, but what is the range of symptoms and long-term effects for a healthy non-pregnant adult if they contract Zika disease?
So it's an excellent question, because there's an enormous and unparalleled consequence of Zika for the pregnant woman, obviously, if their baby is infected by that virus, in terms of lifelong disability and debility from microcephaly or a small brain and a small head. That doesn't happen in every woman who's carrying a baby who gets infected with Zika, but it's unfortunately too high of a chance. Those individuals who aren't pregnant and contract Zika virus, it's usually a 5 to 10 day long illness, pretty mild symptoms of fevers. They can get a rash and a lot of aches and pains in their muscles and joints, but it wanes. And if I can say there's one good thing about Zika, is that the protection against getting reinfected is durable. So once you get Zika, you're not going to get Zika again. That's why it will go through communities and people will get protected in the community because they've been exposed to it. So that's the one saving grace about this virus. There's a lot of viruses you can get time and time again, like influenza. But once you get Zika, you have protection against getting it again.
And you can ask your question at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop, one word, at wamc.org. How does someone get meningitis, Doc? How protective is the vaccine that is recommended for children? And that's from Lou.
That's a great question, Lou. So the vaccine that we know about, that you're mentioning for meningitis, there's actually a couple different vaccines, or actually there's three different vaccines that were out there that protect against the most common cause of meningitis. So as an infant, kids get this Haemophilus influenza, not the same, that's a bacterial vaccine. It's not like influenza, we talk about the virus influenza. The name of the bacteria is Haemophilus influenza B. It's a highly effective vaccination. We've literally eliminated Haemophilus as a cause of meningitis in this country. Very, very effective. It's probably nearly in the 80 to 90% range.
And yet every once in a while you do see an outbreak.
We don't even see outbreaks of it. It's not contagious person to person. That's Haemophilus meningitis. The next one is pneumococcal meningitis, a very common cause of meningitis across the age groups, kids all the way into people who are late in their years. There's vaccine that kids get, and there are vaccines that adults over the age of 60 get. And it's a very effective vaccine, but it's not 100% protective. The ones you're talking about, or the caller's talking about, is meningococcal vaccination. That's the kind of meningitis people can transmit person to person. It can go through communities here in schools, military recruits,
college
campuses, things like that. Those are the vaccines we get in our early teens, and we'll oftentimes get a booster before you go away to college. That vaccination is now been boosted by a second generation of that vaccine because it has more protection, is pretty darn protective in the 70 to 90% range in terms of protecting people against meningitis.
Okay, so we heard from Astrally, who says, my experience is that most doctors and hospitals in this area and everywhere are woefully undereducated as to the clinical manifestations of both Lyme and babesiosis, often relying on the two-tiered testing protocol, which misses up to 60% of the cases. And then he goes on and on. And I just wondered if that's enough, or shall I read?
No, don't go on. It's okay.
Yeah.
So I don't think people are woefully untrained for it, and I wouldn't, you know, frankly, as an infectious disease trained specialist who abides by some, I think, pretty good guidelines, I would not say it misses 60% of the cases out there, but we can leave that alone.
So the Governor Cuomo seems to be warning that the Zika is going to get up here. Is it?
It depends about the fitness of the virus in the type of mosquitoes we have in our communities. We don't have the same mosquito that has spread the virus in much of the southern hemisphere and into the Caribbean and even into southern Florida. So we have to have the ability of our native mosquitoes here, which is a different type of mosquito, to be able to be infected and harbor the Zika virus. That has not yet been proven. You know, there's no reason to get our guard down about it. There's so much international and interstate travel, people coming from Florida to New York State that can actually come in here with the Zika virus, but to have it transmitted from one person to another by our mosquitoes has not yet been proven around our area.
So you're the expert. And I know everybody's working on this like crazy, but what's the chance we're going to have that vaccine?
I think that's clearly at the forefront of everybody's effort right now. I think we'll get a vaccine. I think, you know, we've been able to produce great vaccines against a whole host of viruses like yellow fever, which is transmitted by mosquitoes. I think that the war against Zika is going to be not spraying with larvicides and adulticides, pesticides, but it's going to be with the production of a vaccination. And I think I have just great faith in what we're doing in our country to put together an effective vaccine. That's what's going to stop it.
We have a fairly long message. Let me see if I can, because we're running out of time, if I can get to it. My dad is 83, septic 9 years ago for 4 months, diabetic, due to having acromegaly, A-C-R-O-M-E-G-A-L-Y. He was in the hospital November 2015 for urinary tracts, been on antibiotics for 9 years. I'm worried about this and feel at this point he's resistant to the med. Recently, he's cataract surgery, and we're told he had MRSA, MRSA. No one ever told us this. No one ever wore gown or gloves when treating him. We don't think the CDC was notified. To date, the hospital has not gotten back to us. It's been over a month. We want this cleared up. What are we going to do to this point to get answers? D from Glenmont.
Kind of a complicated question, but it's okay. I'd see if I can tease it apart a little bit. So,
well, unfortunately, we have about a minute to
okay,
do that.
So MRSA, if we identify MRSA in a patient in the hospital, we are supposed to be using gowns and gloves in appropriate isolation. Not all MRSA needs to be treated, though. People sometimes we would say are colonized with MRSA. They have it on their skin, but it's not causing disease. So some people may not be treated for MRSA because they don't need to be treated for MRSA because it's just something that's not infecting them. It's just lying on them. So we have to take precautions not to give it to somebody else.
Okay. We have a note from Fraser who says, Dr. Sand has been speaking about antibiotic prescription for infection, but we know that the widespread overprescription of antibiotics contributes to microbe resistance. What, if anything, is being done at the institution level to manage antibiotic use and prevent overprescription?
I didn't plant this question, but thank you for it, because it's an incredibly important question. And I, with my colleagues in town here, we run two different antibiotic stewardship programs, one at the Medical Center Hospital here in Albany, yep, 5 days a week, and one at St. Peter's Hospital, we round 3 days a week, and
okay,
Memorial
so what's a stewardship?
Hospital. That means the infectious disease doctor will walk around the hospital with a pharmacist and go to different patients' charts who are on inappropriate antibiotics, too many antibiotics, not the right antibiotic, when they don't have an infection or they have a very simple infection. And we, every single day of the week, we recommend de-escalating the antibiotics that they're on. And now CMS, so the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, is requiring all hospitals to start an antibiotic stewardship program. We're ahead of the curve here in Albany. We have it in all of our big hospitals.
Isn't that great? Okay, we're out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in. Apologize to those left who have sent us messages. I'd also like to thank Dr. Alan Sanders for joining us. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the Capital Region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, ACTSURG.com. Again, thanks for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Mackowitz. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I don't know who is handling, who our telephone provider is, but I'm going to call them. I'm Alan Shartok. Stay tuned now for a news update. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.